Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Bill Press Pod, and thank you for joining us. You know, we pride ourselves on being a nation of laws, not of men and women, where the law applies equally and where no man or woman is above the law. Yet today, our system of laws is under attack like never before from the very top. We have a president who's attacked the Attorney General, the FBI, and the Justice Department, a president who tramples on the separation of powers, a president who overturns convictions made by military tribunals, a president who defies a court order to turn over his tax returns, a president who claims he could shoot and kill somebody on Fifth Avenue, yet not be charged with a crime because, as long as he's president, he is in fact above the law. And a president who ordered his White House counsel to fire the Attorney General. How should any White House counsel deal with such a lawless president? We sat down to explore that question with Greg Craig, former White House counsel under President Obama.
Greg, it's good to see you. Thanks for joining us. You were a White House counsel for President Obama. As White House counsel, if the president ever gave you an order to do something that you felt was wrong, what would you do?
I'd try to talk him out of it. Or I'd find other people to help me talk him out of it. And I would find ways of changing his direction or modifying it. I think there are always ways. But that problem never happened, Bill. I mean, I might have a disagreement with a president and think it's a mistake for her to do something because of a policy disagreement. But I never was asked to do anything that I thought was an abuse of his power or was wrongful, either ethically or legally. So let's just eliminate the hypothetical. Yeah. And then if that hypothetical did exist and he did ask me to do something wrong, I would have tried very hard to talk him out of it.
So flash forward to the current administration where things operate a little differently.
Well, I don't know exactly how they operate because I've not had insight into...
We know the president, for example, told Don McGahn to fire Jeff Sessions.
And I don't think he did.
And to his credit, he did not, right?
What seems to me to be a constant theme coming out of this White House is chaos. And for example, right now we're still learning about the degree of distrust and lack of cooperation between Mulaney and the White House counsel, the current White House counsel. And that there's always that. There's always a little bit of tension and either distrust or, watching yourself with all the co-people that you're working with. But there's also an overriding common purpose that overwhelms those disagreements all the time. And it just doesn't seem that the overwhelming common purpose in this White House is overwhelming those disagreements. It's chaotic and disorganized and confused.
But in that position as White House counsel, did you understand or believe that there were limits to presidential power?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, I can remember a conversation as I came in and Fred Feeling was leaving. And we had worked through the transition very effectively. I think perhaps the George W. Bush, Barack Obama transition is one of the great transitions in the history of presidential administrations. And Fred said, and his letter that he left to me under under the blotter said, you always have to remember that this job is a job that serves the institution of the presidency, not the individual of the president. And I don't think there was any doubt in President Obama's mind that that was my formal function. And he always addressed me in the context of what official duties I had and how I could best serve those obligations while working for him.
And now we have a president who has said that under the Constitution, Article 2, I can do whatever I want.
It appears to be. I've not had a conversation with him about the Constitution or his interpretation of it, but it does seem that he views his writ as being pretty much unlimited, whether it's foreign policy or whether it's a military policy, where the limits are few and far between in both of those areas. And his greatest frustration, of course, is dealing with the Congress.
Right. And did you receive any subpoenas from Congress, and how did you respond to them? Of course, the Trump White House saying they do not have to obey any congressional subpoenas.
Well, you should remember that I was White House counsel during the first part of Obama's first term. And those first 2 years, we had a Democratic majority in both the House and the Senate. Right. So I would get letters from various ranking members of the minority party asking, not politely, but demanding. And we would not respond to those because those letters making requests of interviews for interviews or for the production of documents did not have the official stamp of the Congress and weren't subpoenas. So I could answer your question. During the time I was White House counsel, we never got any subpoenas from the Congress.
Right. So that question never came up.
Never came up.
How about executive orders? Were they ever challenged? I remember that the president, as I recall, initially saying that there's a limited use of executive orders, but he ended up signing more, maybe after you left.
No. We had, during the transition, there was a major project focused on executive orders. And I think this is true for every transition, whatever the president, particularly if there's a change in party, because there's a bunch of automatic changes in policy that can happen with executive order. And
just sort of setting a new course.
And they're not particularly controversial, although the topic may be controversial. Everybody knows that if a Democratic president is going to come in, that president is going to change policy in this area, UN funding or something, you know. So we had teams working on various subject matters during the transition, focused on a number of things. One, identifying those areas that the president really wanted to make really changes immediately. And then also making sure that we had touched base with the stakeholders, which included Congress, because the every single topic that you were going to address, whether it was a teenage pregnancy or new drug formats, there was always a group of members in the House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats, who cared a lot. And so you wanted to get them in the process. And then there were stakeholders that were non-governmental operators that you also wanted to get in the process. I can remember Walt Dellinger telling me that during the Clinton transition, they came up right away with 10 executive orders that the president signed, and they had to redo four or five of them because they had not done the due diligence.
Right.
We had 37 executive orders in his menu on January 20th.
Whoa.
And the first one had to do with ethics in government. I think the next three had to do with Guantanamo, no torture, creating task forces, a new policy on rendition. And all those were executive orders. And I think we had a pretty high batting average. I think the president and his political advisor picked the time when they were going to unveil this particular executive order or that particular executive order. But our batting average, I think, was pretty high on sticking with those executive orders and making them work. Now, that's, as I say, only the first part of the administration, and we had a Democratic majority in both houses.
One area that has come up recently in terms of highlighting the role, perhaps, of the White House counsel is President Trump's decision to overrule military tribunals in three cases just in the last week or so. Again, in your position as White House counsel, I'm sure you didn't have anything like that to deal with President
Obama.
Well,
we did have...
Does the president have authority to do that? And we know that Richard Spencer, of course, the Navy Secretary, was forced out because he disagreed with the president's policy.
I'm not sure I know all the details about why he was forced out. It may have been a procedural...
He was told to resign.
I'm sure he was told to resign, and I think the Secretary of Defense was adamant that he resigned because of his going to the White House without the Secretary of Defense knowing. I'm not sure I know exactly where Spencer was on the issue that was the subject of the discussion, which was the seal, the Navy seal, and whether he would have his trident removed. But if military law and the JAG system, the criminal justice system inside the military, is different from the military tribunals. When I think of military tribunal, I think of the Guantanamo process that is trying the alleged, the terrorists that were responsible for 9/11. But the criminal justice system in the military is subject to the command structure and the chain of command. And the president as commander-in-chief and the principle of civilian government of the military, civilian control of the military, has the right, and I would defend this as it should be. If the president thinks that there's an injustice in the military criminal justice system, he has the right to either provide clemency or to provide a pardon. Now, how he does it and what he does it for is a different question.
The question about this advance cooperation or conversations that I'm sure the Obama administration would have undertaken did not happen in this case.
This goes apparently back to the confusion, chaos, and cooperation. Right. The president just seems to be standing up there on Mount Olympus throwing his lightning bolts about without paying much attention as to what kind of confusion results. I think on the question of the criminal justice system inside the military and trying war criminals, because I think Gallagher had gone through a trial, there are two issues. One is the wisdom of second-guessing what the military courts had concluded. And there were two other soldiers, one a lieutenant and one a captain, who had been convicted of war crimes that the president pardoned. And then there was Gallagher, who had actually been acquitted.
Of murder, but convicted
had,
on a...
Convicted on having his photo taken with a corpse. And the question then... after the president pardoned him, was whether or not the military, the SEALs, had the authority to take away his trident, to essentially to bust him and throw him out of the unit. And the president intervened and prevented them from doing that.
You think he had the right to do that as commander-in-chief?
Yes, he does.
Wise or not, he had the right.
Wise or not is the question.
Time for a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod, and as we take a break, here's a special message for this holiday season. Feeling cold weather coming on, wanting to get a head start on your holiday shopping? Two good reasons to take a look at those beautiful hand-woven scarves by my wife, Carol. Each scarf is hand-woven, each one's a work of art, made of rayon chenille or bamboo, and they come in all kinds of colors, designs, and patterns. Believe me, there's no better gift for yourself or for someone you love. Here's all you need to do. Check out Carol's own website, carolpressscarves.com, or follow the link to Carol Press Scarves from my own website, billpresspods.com. Yep, get it together. Have the happiest of holidays with an original, hand-woven Carol Press scarf.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Let's talk a little bit about impeachment. The public hearings have concluded, unless John Bolton changes his mind. Do you think the Democrats made their case?
I do. I look at it from the first from a legal point of view and a sort of beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And if you look at the witnesses and the evidence that was presented in the 2 weeks, I think there were 11 witnesses or so. It was persuasive to the point of beyond a reasonable doubt, I think. And it was not just witnesses testifying as to what they heard and what they saw. You had the president's words testified to appearing in that transcript or that memo of the conversation and overheard by others. And then also you had specific witnesses that were carrying out the president's orders that testified they were the president's orders. So I came away thinking that the case was powerful, the witnesses were impressive, and the case against the president for abusing his authority was convincing.
And an impeachable offense?
I think an impeachable offense. An impeachable offense, during the early days of the Clinton impeachment process, we were talking about conduct that did not rise to the level of an impeachable offense all the time. We said whatever you thought about what the president had done, however blameworthy it was, how offended you were by his comportment, it did not rise to the level of an impeachable offense. And
just,
to me—
Just a quick note. Sure. I made that argument every night on Crossfire at the time because I believed it.
Yeah.
I still believe it.
I think impeachment was put into the Constitution as a provision that protected the body politic from future abuse of power. It was, I hate to use this phrase, but it's accurate. It's a prophylactic. Mm-hmm. It is, because of the abuse of power in the past, there's a concern that the president will do it again. And that is what I think impeachment is supposed to do. There's no legal standard. You can, Bob Byrd said, I think President Clinton did everything he's accused of, but I'm going to vote to acquit him because it would be bad for the country. Now, that's sort of not what a juror is supposed to do. It's not a jury process, really. It is, at the end of the day, is it good to have this person removed from the presidency or is it bad? So you're looking at not just a disagreement of policy. You're looking at whether the president, the incumbent president, has abused his power and misused his office. And I think that's a big difference between President Clinton, who was impeached for a private act of misconduct, versus President Trump, who I think may well be impeached for the abuse of his power in foreign policy and national security affairs.
Right. So you believe that the Democrats put forth credible witnesses, made a strong, compelling case. What did you think of their Republicans' defense of the president's call?
Well, it's disappointing. I don't think they ever really met the evidence of wrongdoing directly. They were always looking at other things. Well, we should call the whistleblower. Well, we should call the Bidens. Well, we should really call Adam Schiff to find out if he consulted with the whistleblower. And I don't know that... Oh, or then the other one was, oh, it didn't get done. You know, yes, he might have threatened to withhold, but ultimately they still got the money and the investigation didn't occur. So what? And I think it was disappointing in that I think there are honorable Republicans who knew exactly what they were doing and nonetheless went ahead and did it.
Mm-hmm. And the final defense was in 2016, Ukraine tried to interfere in the and did in the American election. It wasn't Russia, right? Yeah,
that was a product of Russia disinformation that seemed to find life in the White House.
And as Fiona Hill said, was a total fabrication.
Yeah.
Right. So when you...
What an impressive witness she was.
By the way, yes.
Yeah. Now that you mention her name.
As I think they all were. And, you know, I just interjecting, at first I was worried that these were not, these were career diplomats who might not take a position on impeachment, but I think their strength was that they were career Democrats, or diplomats who did not take a stand on impeachment.
They were there just to testify as to the facts.
Right, right.
Straight and narrow. That's what it was really, that was one of the reasons they were so impressive, I think, actually.
So it appears that articles of impeachment will be drawn up. That given the votes in the House will impeach Donald Trump. And then we look at the Senate trial. You've spoken a little bit about due process. What do you see coming in the Senate trial? Will it be a full trial? Will it be a quickie trial that Mitch McConnell guys go through? How do you,
you'll have to
anticipate?
I think the person you have to ask about that is Mitch McConnell. Now, when Trent Lott and Tom Daschle put together the rules of the road for the Clinton impeachment trial, it took a little bit of work to make that happen. And there was not an agreement, even when we started going, as to how this trial was going to be conducted. Compared to Andrew Johnson's trial, where they had the rules all laid out and the trial went on for 2.5 months plus, and there was 41 witnesses. And, you know, they were, the senators were much, much more participants in the trial process than mm-hmm. they were in the Clinton trial. But it really is up to each Senate group as a group to develop its own rules. And the way in which it was done in the past or the way in which it's done with judges is not binding on this sentence, so this on this Senate. So it's going to be very much up to Mitch McConnell and whether he wants to work with Chuck Schumer, as Trent Lott worked with Daschle, or do it on his own. My guess is he's going to do his own rules. And so he's going to have to answer questions. Are we going to have live witnesses? He could. And Andrew Johnson's, they had 41 witnesses. Are we going to have Senate participation? He could, or he could just have them sitting there like bumps on a log the way it was done mm-hmm. during the Clinton trial. Is it going to be a long trial, or is it going to be a short trial? So there's a lot of variations that I don't know how he's going to make those decisions. I can only speculate.
Every member of the Senate is a juror.
Yeah.
Correct? No matter what committee they're on, right?
So that's right. Equal vote.
100 jurors. In the last week, the president has been inviting Republican senators down to the White House to discuss strategy with them about arguments to be made or whatever counterarguments in this trial. In your mind, does this get close to jury tampering?
Close. It reminds me of an event that happened very early on in my service. I was called to sort of coordinate or quarterback the impeachment defense from various parts of the White House into all one sort of coherent group, and not just the lawyers and the outreach people and the congressional people. They were all going to have a war room. Mm-hmm. And so when the Star report came out and was sent up, they needed another lawyer to go out and be the face of the defense. And so there I was on a morning talk show, and the questions came, do you know that your client has been calling up senators and asking them to sign a letter saying they'd never vote for impeachment? Some senator from Louisiana by the name of John Breaux had been talking to President Clinton and given him the idea. And so Clinton had been calling senators. Oh. This was very early in the process.
Your role at the time was?
My title was assistant and special counsel to the president for impeachment. Mm-hmm. So I reported directly to the president, but I worked very closely with Chuck Ruff, who was White House counsel, and David Kendall, who was his personal lawyer. And it turns out that I had not known about that, and he had been doing that, and it stopped instantly the moment that Senator Byrd went to the floor and started pointing his finger up at the dais and said, Mr. President, do not tamper with this jury. So there is a line mm-hmm. Which is consultation versus tampering?
The question is asked often. Love to get your take on it. Okay, look, given the current political makeup of the Senate, we know the Senate's not going to convict. So why does the House even go through this impeachment process?
I think they really, given the evidence of wrongdoing here and the gravity of the conduct, I don't think they've got much of a choice. I shared the Speaker's reluctance to get into the middle of an impeachment process just prior to the 2020 election because I thought it would suck oxygen out of every other aspect of public life. And it has. You know, the campaigns are now on page 8. Mm-hmm. There are 4 stories on the front page. All the talk shows are impeachment. And so to the extent in terms of political advantage, I think it may well redound to the detriment of the Democrats that they're doing this because it's very difficult to have a domestic or foreign policy political position to present to the nation when you're just dealing with, you know, the Ukraine problem. So I think they have to do it. I think they feel they have to do it. I think their hearings were very impressive, well-organized, well-structured. The lawyering, Dan Goldman deserves an enormous amount of credit, as does the chairman himself. Mm-hmm. And the witnesses, of course, as I said, I thought were superb.
We are speaking on a Monday afternoon, November 25, with Greg Craig, former White House counsel under President Obama. And later today, a district judge in Washington has promised that she's going to rule on whether the White House counsel, Don McGahn, has to respond to a congressional subpoena to testify in an unimpeachment-related matter. But we don't know how she's going to rule, but as a former White House counsel, can you inform us what you think what might be the results if she says, yes, the White House counsel has to answer the subpoena, or if she says just the opposite? There's a lot riding on this?
Yeah. There are a lot of principles at issue here that are not easily sorted out because I do believe that the president is entitled to confidential advice and counsel from his advisors, particularly in the national security area, and executive privilege has been recognized as being strongest in that particular mm-hmm. aspect of his office. And so I'm unhappy about the idea that there is a penetration of the executive privilege in national security affairs. But it does seem to me that if there's prima facie evidence of misconduct, then the executive privilege claim or bar is reduced in its strength. I would be sad to see the entirety of executive privilege trampled because of President Trump's conduct in these matters. And I think it's not an easy thing, should not be an easy thing, to compel the president's lawyer to go testify and perhaps share confidences that he'd had with the president. That's an important principle. And just because you have a president who doesn't sort of seem to respect the rule of law doesn't mean you throw out these very important principles of government.
Do you find, as a member of the legal profession, are you worried about the rule of law today or the system of justice today, given a president who seems to trample on the law any chance that he has, whether trying to fire the attorney general, firing the FBI director, or refusing to obey certain norms? Has the system suffered under Donald Trump irreparably, or can it come back?
Well, I hope it's not irreparable, and I have confidence that it will come back. It's troubling. It's discouraging. In my experience in this city and working in and out of government, both on the Hill as a staffer for a senator, in the executive branch, I found that on both sides of the aisle, at least in my experience up until this date, there's been a general respect and understanding for the basic norms of conduct. And that it's sad to see a person of such influence, visibility, and power not having that kind of respect. And clearly the rule of law suffers from it. And all the boundaries get blurred if not just trampled?
One person that we would expect to maybe fight back or uphold the rule of law would be the Attorney General of the United States. What's your take on Bill Barr?
Well, I don't know the gentleman. I've had brief contact with him only professionally, but I'm, you know, I don't agree with his the way he's handling his office.
It appears, right, that he accepts the role of
the lawyers for the president, the lawyer for the president.
Donald Trump's personal lawyer.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Seems that way.
Co-sharing that role with Rudy Giuliani. Or maybe I should ask you about Rudy Giuliani's conduct.
Well, I think I know more about Rudy Giuliani's conduct than I know about Bill Barr's. You know, I think the Attorney General is always in a tough position, but his primary or her primary loyalty should be to uphold the Constitution and respect the rule of law. That should be, in fact, the primary purpose of his service.
And has been under Republican and Democratic administrations, correct?
Certainly has.
Yeah, right. So a final question. The last time I saw you, we were together at a book party for Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado, who is, yes, indeed, a candidate for president in 2020, although not one of the ones that's been on the stage in the last couple of debates. Is he your candidate and why?
He is my candidate. I've known him for years and think the world of him. He is not an extremist ideologically. He is, by temperament, someone who sees where progress can be made and goes to do it effectively without alienating people or polarizing people. He is well-read. He's bright. He's on top of every single policy issue, whether it's climate change or, you know, terrorism, or particularly education, given his own personal experience as the superintendent of schools in Denver. It's just a mix of youth. He's, you know, in his early 50s, of experience. He has been an executive of a major organization, and he's been a legislator, and of temperament, to say nothing of intellect. So, I'm enthusiastically for Senator Bennett.
And still a long way to go, I guess.
Oh, huh? Yeah, I think so.
All right. Great. It's great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
And that's a wrap for today's podcast with former White House counsel Greg Craig. Again, thank you so much for joining us. But before you go, please do us a big favor. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the Bill Press Pod. Just go to wherever you check out your favorite podcast, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or TuneIn. Search for the Bill Press Pod and click on subscribe. It's that easy and it's free. You know, we only remind you of that because it's so important. And by the way, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Bill Press Pod. That way you'll get notice of all upcoming podcasts so you won't miss a single one. Again, thanks so much for listening. Always good to have you with us. Now stay strong, and we'll be looking for you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.